Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 419. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have just a wonderful show for you this week. Let me introduce our guest. Dr. Gail Pittman is a professor of psychology and women's studies at Sacramento City College. Her teaching and writing focuses on gender and sexual orientation. She is the author of so many books, including Backdrop, The Politics and Personalities Behind Sexual Orientation Research, This Day in June, which won the American Library Association's 2015 Stonewall Book Award, Bell's Garden, the brand new book, When You Look Out the Window, How Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin Built a Community, and the forthcoming book, Feminism A to Z. And with just those few sentences, she makes me feel like a slacker professor. So let's see how much we can deepen that feeling as we chat. Gail, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. My goal is not to make you feel bad about yourself or inadequate.
Well, we have so much in common and so much to chat about. Gail, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
When little Gail Pittman was running around suburban New Jersey, was the goal to be a professor of psychology and women's studies?
Oh my gosh, no. Well, when I was a little girl running around in suburban New Jersey, I always loved books. I always loved reading. I think I preferred reading more than playing outside or being with friends, although I certainly had friends. But it really wasn't until I was in college, past college, kind of into my young adulthood, that I became kind of awakened to politics and social justice issues and all those sorts of things. But I've been a book person ever since I was very little. I don't think I ever considered myself to be a writer. I don't think I really had a vision of what I would grow up to be. As I got older and progressed through junior high, high school, and so forth, I really thought that I was going to be a lawyer.
Nice.
My dad was a lawyer. I think I felt like I was going to be following in his footsteps. And I didn't realize it then, but I realize now that I was really drawn to social change. And I guess in my junior high or high school mind, I saw that as a way of potentially making change. Once I got to college, though, I changed my mind very quickly. That was not what I wanted to do at all. So my path to writing has been kind of roundabout. It was not a linear, you know, vision that I had in early childhood that I am going to be a writer and write the great American novel. It wasn't anything like that at all.
Well, we have to do that thing that we people in New Jersey do. Which exit on the Garden State Parkway, Gail?
Oh my gosh. Are you from New Jersey?
I am.
Oh my goodness. Well, see, I'm sort of from a funky part of New Jersey because I lived in an area that wasn't on the Turnpike or the Parkway. I grew up in a small town called Denville, New Jersey, which is just outside Morristown.
Actually, yes, of course.
More frequently call it Chris Christie country because that's the area that he's from. And I'm not saying that because I'm proud of it. It just is what it is. I guess it depends on which freeway you're talking about.
So
I lived off Route 10 and Route 287. And oh my gosh, I wish I could remember what exit it was. And I don't remember. That feels like heresy.
My folks would be jumping through the phone right now if I could remember the exit. Let me just put that out there. I want to assure my mother and father, should you be listening to this week's episode, of course I know it's exit 172. Gail did not know hers, but what are you going to do? What are you going to
do? That's because I didn't grow up near the parkway or the turnpike. You have to drive a ways to get to either one of them.
Now, in looking at your background, it strikes me that the move to the San Francisco Bay Area was a big deal for you.
Yeah, it was a very big deal. The impetus for moving to the Bay Area was graduate school, but I also applied to a graduate school in the Bay Area because I was excited about the possibility of moving out to that part of the country. And yeah, it was a turning point, I would say, in my young adult life. I mean, not only was it exciting to be going to graduate school and pursuing a career, and by then I didn't know I was going to go the writing route, but I absolutely knew that I was interested in psychology, I was interested in women and gender studies, I was interested in sexual orientation and gender identity. Like, all of those were abundantly clear, and I absolutely had a social justice you know, mission, I guess you could say. You know, I was very much invested in making social change in some way, shape, or form. So just the prospect of moving out to the Bay Area and, you know, moving on career-wise was very exciting. And when I got to the Bay Area, it was 1994. It was the height of the third wave of feminism. The AIDS crisis was, you know, really, I mean, it had dragged on for over a decade by that point without very much movement in terms of finding effective treatments or prevention or what have you. And so it was a really exciting time to be in the Bay Area, be involved in activism and social justice efforts, finding myself, you know, becoming clear about my own sexuality and who I am and what I'm about and, you know, where I'm going. It was a very exciting time.
Amazing, amazing stuff. I don't talk about a lot of people's dissertations on this show over the past 10 years, but we have to talk about yours because we don't often talk about the relationship between body dissatisfaction and internalized homophobia in lesbian women. We hear a lot about body dissatisfaction with gay men, but not nearly enough out there about that in lesbian women.
I love that you dug up my dissertation, or at least the title. Because oftentimes dissertations are kind of a means to an end, right? People write them and then they, you know, hopefully graduate from their program and then it just sits on a shelf and collects dust. Well, so some of the desire to focus on body image in lesbian women came, of course, from personal concerns. I mean, I struggled when I was in high school, but definitely in college with body image and eating disorder symptoms. And actually, there was a point in college where it became very serious and I needed to take some time off to, you know, get some help and help get that taken care of. And it was right around the time that I was starting to question my sexuality and start to wake up to feminism. And the whole thing was just, like, I couldn't find anything at that point that reflected my experience at all. Like, everything that I could find about body image or weight or eating disorders or what have you really focused on young, straight, you know, heterosexual white women, mostly middle class. You know, it's like there was a type that was really kind of presented over and over again. And I just had this feeling that, you know, that might be the narrative that's being put out there, but I don't think that's necessarily the truth, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
And so I decided to explore that more. I started, and I think that that partly was my means to an end dissertation, get out of graduate school process, but I also think it was partly a personal healing process. Just to see that I wasn't necessarily alone in that experience. And I came across a few different articles and a couple of researchers that were interested in that topic, but there just really wasn't that much traction at the time in the mid-90s. And so I started doing my research, and oh my gosh, it was fascinating to see not only how many women of all sexual orientations and gender identities for that matter. I mean, we really weren't talking about trans in the mid-90s in the way that we are now, but there were quite a few trans people that participated in the study and, you know, shared their experiences. And it was just fascinating to see. It was fascinating and, you know, vindicating in some way, but it was also depressing to see, wow, just the amount of body image baggage that's out there. And, you know, on top of that, the fact that most of the participants that I spoke with really felt like there just wasn't a place to talk about it. It was almost like it was un-PC to, you know, be lesbian or be queer or be feminist, for that matter, and have any kind of body, because we were supposed to be above that, right? Like, we're smarter than that, or we're more educated, or we're more, like, aware and enlightened. And I think, if anything, people felt more guilty by having these kinds of feelings. And so it was a fascinating study that I did. I'm really glad. I'm glad that you asked that question, because I'm proud of that work, and I don't really get much opportunity to talk about it.
I would like to believe we've solved all those issues, but I have a feeling that we still have more work to do.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I haven't done work in that area for quite some time, but that's, I don't think it's getting better.
Yeah. Well, we are going to talk all about the books in a minute, but I have to ask you, who is Dr. Gail Pittman as a professor?
Who am I as a professor? Boy, that's a good question. Well, I teach at Sacramento City College, which is a community college in North Central California. My students are from all different backgrounds. Most of my students are very low income. My classrooms are very racially and ethnically diverse. And because I teach classes on the psychology of women and sexual orientation and gender, I tend to get a lot of sexual and gender diversity. And so, you know, the trans students that are on campus, the queer students that are on campus, most of them find their way to my class in some way. And so I like to think that it's an educational opportunity for them, but it's also kind of like a safe place. It's a place where they can find community that's not necessarily like going to the bars or going to an LGBT center, or, you know, it's another avenue for them to be able to connect with people and find themselves.
Yeah. And what do we say, Gail, to all of those folks, right? We couldn't be having more conversations right now about whether or not there's a place for social justice in the college classroom and freedom of expression and what that looks like on a college campus. What do we say to those who say it's just not the place for those types of conversations?
Oh my gosh, I think it is exactly the place for those kinds of conversations. I think that in order to be informed, knowledgeable, aware, you know, critical citizens, really, residents, people who are engaged in discourse throughout our country, I think we have to engage in those kinds of conversations. I always say in my classrooms that my goal is not, we talk about the difference between safe space versus brave space, that obviously it's my job to make sure that the classroom is a safe environment, that, you know, that I'm going to do my best with whatever's within my power to keep them physically safe, but I'm not going to protect them from discomfort. And there's a difference between the two, that discomfort is actually the place where people are most likely to learn the most powerful lessons. And if I protect them from that, I'm doing them a disservice. And I think college is one of those places where we really should be embracing that rather than trying to fight it.
I'm stealing that for my own work. Yay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So many books to talk about. Let's start with When You Look Out the Window, How Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin Built a Community, which I enjoyed immensely, Gail.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Tell everybody how this book came to be.
Well, it didn't initially occur to me to write a children's book about Phyllis and Del. I had interviewed Phyllis Lyon, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, I want to say. I was working on a different project, which ultimately has not been completed, that was essentially an oral histories project. I was seeking out people from various queer communities throughout the United States, who basically were people who whose lives weren't necessarily represented heavily in the common queer narrative. People of color who were queer, trans people, older individuals. That's kind of what got me drawn to Phyllis Lyon. And so I called her up. It's so funny. I, you know, kind of tracked down how to get a hold of her. And it's funny, a friend of mine had done some work with Phyllis and said that her phone number's in the phone book. And I'm thinking, oh my God. And this is, you know, again, even 5 or 6 years ago, like who used a phone book? Who even had a phone book?
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, I don't know if I can dig up the phone book. But I found her number and I called her up and she picked up, I want to say, on the second ring. And within 2 days, we had an interview set up. And I'm like, wow, okay, that was really easy to set up an interview with Phyllis Lyon.
And we should back up a step. In the event that we have listeners who don't know who Phyllis Lyon is, which you and I have to talk about the importance of history in a second. But let's start in that place of, should someone be listening and saying, is that Gail's aunt? I don't know who that is.
Yeah, right. No, that's fair. I made a grand assumption that, of course, everybody knows who Phyllis Lyon is, which is partly why I wrote the book.
Right.
So Phyllis and Del they met in the 1950s. Both of them had moved separately to the Bay Area in the early 1950s, and then they met and they fell in love and became a couple, and then bought a house together in 1953 and lived together up until Del Martin died in 2008. Phyllis is still living. She's still in that same house. And what they're really most known for, I mean, I always call them kind of lovingly the godmothers of the queer movement, especially the lesbian and feminist movements. And I don't think they get due credit most of the time for the activism that they've done over the decades, because they were out and active and vocal and involved all the way from the beginning. And I think about the 1950s, which was such an oppressive time for so many people, but especially for LGBT people, where there was the Cold War and the fear of communism and the Red Scare and persecution of anybody who was considered to be leftist or radical or different or non-mainstream or queer in any way, shape, or form. And to think that Phyllis and Del were really starting their activist efforts during that period and in that climate is just mind-boggling to
me.
It's amazing. And they basically got started and never stopped. They've been involved in many, many different efforts, including efforts to create inclusiveness within churches and religious and spiritual spaces, within the feminist movement, particularly with their work with the National Organization for Women. They just have done so much activism, and the fact that they have made so much, they've affected so much change and yet have gotten so little recognition outside of the San Francisco area is amazing to me.
Why should we pick up this book and give it to children?
Because I think children need, especially now with the ridiculous, in my view, political climate that we're in, I think children need to see voices of hope, and they need to understand that we all have agency. And Phyllis and Dell were living in very oppressive times. I mean, it's quite interesting to think about today and the 1950s and make comparisons of similarities and differences, and that's probably a whole separate conversation. But I think that the book really starts out with kind of describing, kind of from Phyllis and Dell's perspective, looking out their window in their living room, which, by the way, overlooks the entire panorama of San Francisco. It's just an amazing view that they have from their home, tiny home that they had. You know, kind of pointing out back when they first moved in together what it was like, you know, like what was their neighborhood like and what were the people like and how were they received? And, you know, not surprisingly, they obviously weren't received very well. They weren't welcomed in their neighborhood. They weren't welcomed in San Francisco. And they could have hunkered down in their house and just lived a very quiet, closeted life together, and they didn't. They were out. They were open. They started the first lesbian organization that eventually achieved nationwide status. They took it on, and I think that that's a really powerful message for children and actually for adults to get, that, you know, there's a lot going on that's very oppressive and very scary, and if we can find it within ourselves to stand up against it and speak out and take action and form community, because I think that the most powerful activism happens within the context of community. If we can do all those things, then that's how change happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's just it's a message that really needs to be spread.
All for it. Again, listeners, we are here with Dr. Gail Pittman, professor, author, so much more. We would be remiss if we didn't highlight, you know, we do the latest LGBTQ news on every week's episode, and there's been this whole rash of stories these days, Gail, of children's books under fire because they have any remote connection to LGBTQ themes. How do we approach this in a sensitive way that still gets this information in people's hands?
Right. So I imagine that you're referring to, without actually naming it, the recent controversy around my first children's book. Am I correct in that?
There was that as well. There have been at least three or four stories in the past couple weeks just about, hey, these books are not age appropriate, not because they're not accessible or have anything inappropriate in them, but because they have any LGBTQ content whatsoever,
right.
Of which,
right.
Yes, I am sure that you are aware of that too personally.
Yeah. And it actually hits very close to home because not only has my book, my first book, This Day in June, been challenged the first time a couple of years ago, the most recent time a couple of weeks ago, but there's been a situation locally here for me in the Sacramento area where maybe you've heard about it, where the kindergarten child
yes.
who is transgender brought a book to school, and the child's teacher read it. It was the book I Am Jazz,
yes.
which is a beautiful book. If listeners have never read it before, it's an amazing book, very sweet and very kid appropriate. Anyway, long story short, some parents got really upset about it and took their children out of school, and it protested the book's presence within the school. And tonight there's a meeting that's happening in front of that school's, I guess it's their board of trustees. So I guess, I don't know, it's interesting to me that it's happening, it seems like it's happening more frequently lately.
Yes.
There have been books being challenged. Actually, the School Library Journal just wrote an article a couple weeks ago in response to This Day in June being challenged, and she even said, and I'm probably going to mangle the quote, but she even said, you know, it's been a long time since a good old-fashioned, you know, homophobic book banning has taken place. And she's kind of right about that. I mean, it happens, but not as frequently as it's been happening lately, and certainly not with as much visibility. I have to think that it has to do partly with the political climate that we're in, that there are people who maybe kept quiet before and, you know, were silent about their political views, or at least tempered them to some extent, that are now feeling emboldened to speak out against LGBT people. It's hard to really wrap my head around why that's happening, but I don't think that the national political climate is helping, that's for sure.
I can't even imagine, if we can make this personal for a second, what is it like to find out? No one that I know is seeking to ban any of my books. Maybe it's happening and I don't know about it, in which case someone please send me an email, because that'd be very exciting news for me to cover. But I also don't know how I would wrap my mind around that actually happening. I can't imagine, Gail, that in the process of writing the book that you saw that as a possible outcome?
No. I mean, I thought that this day in June could be controversial, because the goal in that book was to present our community as honestly and unapologetically as possible.
Right.
And of course, that might upset some people. So, but I never really envisioned it being banned. I actually never really thought of it rising to that national level. I mean, it's, you know, my book was published by a small press, and I just didn't expect it to get the traction that it got. Either way, it's a weird, I don't know, it's a weird experience, because on the one hand, I feel like I'm in good company. And
right.
That's sort of exciting.
There has to be a fist pump for that at some point.
Yeah, right. It's like, okay, you know, like there's something sort of cool about that in its own twisted, subversive way.
I would love there to be footage of some sort of This Day in June book burning, and we look closer and it's you. You're cheering right there because it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool and it's not cool.
Of course.
It's cool in the sense that, you know, I feel like I'm now part of the cool club. You know,
right.
Like I've got my book was banned card or challenged. The other thing that's really interesting is that anytime a book challenge happens, sales go through the roof. So
right.
It helps me financially. But on the flip side, I have seen, it's really scary. I mean, I've seen some really ugly behavior on the part of people who try to ban my book and other books. And that part is really horrible. I mean, it's really sad that visibility, I mean, at the end of the day, I think that these book challenges have given our communities more visibility. And I think it allows people who might not otherwise choose to advocate for LGBT people to do so. But it's sad that it takes that, right? It takes that level of ugliness, that, you know, desire to suppress our identities and our voices and our words to bring people out. It's just a mixed series of feelings that I have about it. There's something kind of exciting about it, but there's also something gross about it, too.
Right. And for folks who don't know, This Day in June, which I love that there was more exposure for it, because it's such a happy, fun book and such a celebratory book for people to have in their hands.
Yeah, that was the goal. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gone to events. And it's a kid's book, right? I mean, it's intended for very young children. It's a simple little rhyming story. I can't tell you how many events I've gone to where adults have picked up the book, started thumbing through it, and then started to cry.
Yeah.
Because they just, because, you know, not because of it's making them sad necessarily, but because it is so happy and it is so joyful. And I think it touches that place in adults that wishes that there was something like that for them when they were kids.
Right.
Something that reflected the joy and the exuberance of who we are.
Yeah. What does it mean for those soon to be or at some point will be LGBTQ young adults that they were able to access this information when they were children?
I think that it'll remain to be seen, right?
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, there haven't been that many books. I mean, Heather Has Two Mommies was really kind of the, you know, the trailblazer in the
right.
children's book world. And that came out in the late 80s. So, you know, we're seeing kind of the first generation of that era now, you know, as grown-ups. And since then, I would say just within the last decade, there have been many, many more books geared towards children about the LGBT community. And I think, you know, time will tell. But I would imagine, it's hard for me to believe that kids, after having exposure to those books, wouldn't be more informed, wouldn't be more aware, and wouldn't be more accepting, both of other people as well as of themselves. I mean, I'm already starting to see that to some extent with my students. And I don't think, obviously, that children's books are the only factor in that. I think that there's been a larger cultural shift that's taken place. But, you know, my students are in such a different place than from where I was when I was their age. And it's really, it's amazing to see. They're much more accepting. They're much more open-minded. They're more willing to hold space for people that are different from themselves. They're also more willing to hold space for themselves when, you know, they don't necessarily fit into like a cookie cutter image of what society expects them to be.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but that TV show Glee changed my teaching quite a bit. It made things easier.
Oh my gosh, yes, absolutely.
Unbelievable stuff. All right, before we get to the forthcoming book, were Dr. Gail Pittman to set out to define the word feminism, how might she approach that?
Boy, that's really complicated. It's simple and it's complicated. At a very basic level, feminism is equality and fairness and equity among people of all genders, male, female, in between, otherwise, or neither, right? And I think on a larger scale, feminism from a philosophical and an activist standpoint involves dismantling the power that males tend to hold in our society, which is a scary thing for a lot of people to hear because I think they interpret that as, oh my gosh, feminists hate men.
Right.
And no, feminists, well, maybe some feminists hate men, right? I can't speak for all feminists. I don't know. But in general, as you know, like as a category, to be feminist does not equate to hating men or hating anybody. What it equates to is uplifting everyone and providing everyone with the same access and opportunities that that we deserve.
So why put it into a children's book?
Well, this one's a little bit different because it's not geared towards young children. This is geared towards teenagers and potentially young adults. So just to backtrack a little bit, so I teach psychology of women at Sac City College, and usually for my students, my class is the first introduction, the first real introduction that they've had to feminism. I mean, they may have heard little snippets here and there or, you know, gotten some information from the media, but most of them bring just stereotypes about what feminism is, and the vast majority of them may believe in equality between people of all genders, but they don't necessarily want to go so far as to call themselves a feminist because there's just a lot that's attached to that word for them. So my point being that, you know, my college students are generally new to this conversation, a larger conversation about feminism. And I feel like in some ways that that's almost too late. And what I mean by that is that I think that teenagers, especially teen girls, but teens of all genders, really could be spared a lot of agony and angst and stress and self-deprecation if they understood feminism and if they understood the ways in which females or non-male individuals lack power in our culture and how that translates to how they're treated or how they're viewed in the world. I just think that that would give so much more perspective to what's going on for a teenager when they're going through the trials and tribulations of adolescence. And that's what sparked the interest in writing the book.
And you're okay with the fact that I'm definitely going to pick it up, even though I'm not a teenage girl?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes. I think that teenagers of any gender, I mean, that was the target audience to, you know, that I was really aiming at. But I think that actually there's quite a few, the book's not officially out yet, but there's a few advanced copies that have been floating around. And already I've been getting feedback primarily from adults about, wow, I wish I'd had this when I was a teenager. Or, wow, I never really understood feminism at this level. I mean, it's intended really to be kind of an introductory level, like feminism 101 kind of thing. But it's amazing. Yeah, I've gotten pretty good reception from adults so far. So please do pick it up and read it. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about it.
Oh, happily, happily. Tell me about one of those post-publishing interactions that you've had. I just feel like with the content that you put out there, there is no shortage of people reaching back out to you to say thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll share a couple. One is I have a coworker at Sac City College who is a very sweet person. I like her a lot. We work well together. She leans a lot more conservative than I do, and we've had some really interesting conversations. And we have the kind of relationship where we don't agree with each other, clearly we don't agree with each other, but we can listen to each other and kind of take in what the other person is saying, and we try to understand rather than, you know, try to force the issue on the other person. It's really kind of interesting. Anyway, she had expressed interest in reading the book, and I'm like, oh, please. I'd love for you to read this
book.
Do
it.
I know, right. And so I gave her a copy, an advanced copy of the book, and oh my gosh, within a couple of days, she just emailed me and said, you know, I'm so glad that you wrote this. It really is powerful. It makes me think about a lot of things. Yeah, she just was very thankful. And We haven't yet circled back and had a deeper conversation, but to hear that as her first response is, you know, is notable. What's also interesting, though, is that in addition to responses like that, which are very positive and, you know, heartwarming and all of that, it's really fascinating to me to see responses from folks who have not yet read the book but have already formed an opinion about it. I've been doing a series of blog posts kind of leading up to some pre-publication buzz for feminism from A to Z. And almost on a daily basis, I get like a hate tweet from some troll on Twitter that, you know, some of them are just like, yuck, feminism, no thank you. Other tweets are just really vile, actually. I've been thinking about compiling these tweets, screenshotting them, compiling them, and writing a blog post about them, because it's really interesting to see how threatened some people are by the concept of feminism, even when they haven't even seen the book, right. Like they haven't read it.
You're triggering them with the title.
I know. They're seeing an image of the cover and they're saying, you know, feminism from A to Z is available for pre-order. And it's like sparking this huge barrage of hate tweets. And that's just fascinating to me. Like that's about something. And I am really, you know, I don't know. I think it's worth exploring what that, you know, what that reaction's about.
Oh my gosh. I love that you're going to compile these and put them out there. I think it's important.
Yeah, that's the plan.
All right.
That's the plan. I mean, there's some real, there's some that are really pretty vile.
It's just kind of awe-inspiring, too, because I know you well enough to know that you're putting stuff out there with the most positive intentions, and yet when you get that energy back, it can stop you for a second.
Totally.
So much more work to do. Well, what is coming up for you that's exciting? Obviously, Feminism A to Z is going to be coming out. I'm a little worried, by the way, Gail, with so much output that you are not stopping enough to appreciate the amazing things that you're putting out there into the world.
The pace lately has been really fast, and that's not been by my design. That's just been sort of the way that the, you know, the cards have fallen. Some of the things that I've written were written a while ago and just only more recently were picked up and, you know, going through the publication process. And so it's just by sort of, you know, happenstance that it's like boom, 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 kind of one thing after another. Because lately I've been sort of feeling the same, like, wow, I barely have time to breathe. And now we've got another book that's coming out and it's exciting, but it also, you know, like there's a time to breathe and to celebrate and enjoy and just sort of bask in it. And I don't feel like that's necessarily been a possibility. But at the same time, I'm very grateful for it. So I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't, you know, trade it for if the alternative is not having those books out in the world, then I'm good with, you know, good with how it's going for sure. But yeah, I do have some things that are coming up on the horizon. There's a book that's coming out next spring. I think it's slated for April or May. I'm not entirely sure. That published by Albert Whitman and Company called A Church for All, which is sort of similar to This Day in June. It's a little rhyming story geared towards young children about an LGBT inclusive church, which I think is another area that you really don't see books about. You don't, you know, there's not really very many materials for children to access about that possibility. So it'll be interesting to see how that's received out into the world for sure.
Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this very second. You can stroll on over to GailPittman.com. That's GailePittman.com, GailPittman.com. And you can learn all about Gail, and you should pick up all of her many books because these are great, great gifts. Pick up When You Look Out the Window, How Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin Built a Community. Most certainly pick up This Day in June. Don't burn it. Give it as a gift. You shouldn't be banning books like this. This is important work. And of course, coming out in just a few weeks, Feminism A to Z. And I have already picked up my copy of that and put in my order. Gail, you're just doing important work. It's so important that we cover the landscape, right? That we have representation at all different levels. And I think the importance of highlighting, hey, this is our shared history, and this is what celebration is, and this is where we came from, and this is where we could be as a harmonious society is important, not just as two professors talking to each other on the phone, but also for children, for teens, for everybody we come into contact with. And so the work that you're doing is just plain important.
Oh, thank you. I feel that. I mean, I think that if anything, you know, one of the things that I really feel is so important is for kids not only to see themselves reflected in books, but also to know their histories. to know where they're, you know, where people came from, to where people from their communities came from and what it took to get where we are now. And I think especially for LGBT folks, we don't get that history. That's not usually taught to us in schools, and families don't often pass it down to us because they don't have access to that information. So if I can get some of that information into the hands of kids, I feel like I'm doing something important.
And I know it wasn't your intention to make me feel like a slacker, but it only got worse and worse during our chat, Gail.
Oh, man, that's not good.
It's okay. It's okay.
I got my game here.
I will happily take your unarticulated offer for a letter from my tenure file, and we'll call it even.
There you go.
All right. I love it. Dr. Gail Pittman is doing incredible work. Go visit her at gailpittman.com. Gail, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. Hillary Clinton made a beautiful tribute to the late activist Edie Windsor at her funeral last week. Windsor, again, we covered this on last week's show. She died last week at the age of 88 after spending years fighting for marriage equality. Hillary Clinton told the crowd that Edie Windsor had left a, quote, positive, lasting influence on our country and the world, and that she, Hillary Clinton, was honored to speak at the funeral. She said this, quote, "When I think of Edie, I think of that line from A Midsummer Night's Dream, and thought she be but little, she is fierce. She was fierce. She helped change hearts and minds, including mine. She refused to give up on the promise of America. There wasn't a cynical, defeatist bone in her body. Through her determination and sheer force of will, she brought us another step closer to a perfect union. It is up to all of us to pick up where she left off." Hillary Clinton went on to say that going forward in the fight for LGBTQ equality, we should remember Edie Windsor and her courage in taking on the U.S. government. Hillary said this, quote, "We really owe it to her to ensure, as I've said before, that gay rights are human rights and human rights are gay rights now and forever. It's easy to grow weary fighting these fights, but remember, Edie Windsor took on and won against the U.S. government. She pushed us all to be better, stand taller, dream bigger. Because of her, people came out, marched in their first pride parade, married the love of their life." Clinton finished the moving tribute by thanking Edie Windsor for, quote, "filling us with a sense of possibility," and Hillary urged those at the funeral to live as vivaciously as she once did. She concluded by saying, "So thank you, Edie. Thank you for being a beacon of hope, for proving that love is more powerful than hate, for filling us with a sense of possibility and promise as we answer the question posed by Mary Oliver, tell me what it is you plan to do with your own one wild and precious life. Let us continue to be inspired by Edie's wild and precious life, and let us make her proud every day of how we answer that question ourselves. Thank you, Edie." Incredible, incredible words. That whole idea of what is it that you all are doing with your own one wild and precious life. Edie Windsor, as Hillary Clinton highlighted, Edie Windsor just made the most of it. And she used her voice in her own unique way to truly make a difference for all of us. And that's what we want to do at the end of each day. We have to say, this is what I did today. And maybe some days aren't as productive as others, but we have to be moving forward. We have to be moving forward together, but you also have to be moving forward yourself in order to use your voice in the way that is going to make you fulfilled. So kudos to Hillary Clinton. And of course, our memories always of Edie Windsor. Now, on last week's episode, we announced that Chelsea Manning was hired by Harvard University for a fellowship. Well, that story changed about a minute and a half after last week's episode went to air. Harvard University has reversed its announcement of a visiting fellowship for Chelsea Manning, who had been invited to discuss LGBT issues. Former soldier Chelsea Manning had been invited last week to take up a temporary visiting fellow position at Harvard's Institute of Politics to discuss LGBTQ identity in the military. Manning is best known as the source of leaked documents that exposed alleged U.S. war crimes and served 7 years behind bars for whistleblowing. Chelsea Manning came out as trans in 2013 and had been denied the right to transition behind bars, leading her to make several suicide attempts, and she was pardoned by President Obama. Harvard University dramatically revoked her invite last week after the CIA pressured them to drop the speaker. The director of the CIA, Michael Pompeo, had dropped out of a Harvard speaking position in protest, saying, quote, "Harvard's announcement of American traitor Chelsea Manning as a visiting fellow at the Institute of Politics, my conscience and duty to the men and women of the CIA will not permit me to betray their trust by appearing to support Harvard's decision. Ms. Manning stands against everything the brave men and women I serve alongside stand for. Let me be clear, this has nothing to do with Ms. Manning's identity as a transgender person. It has everything to do with her identity as a traitor to the United States of America and my loyalty to the officers of the CIA." Well, Michael Morell, the former acting director of the CIA, also resigned his fellowship in Harvard in protest. Douglas Elmendorf, the dean of Harvard's Kennedy School, said this, quote, "We do not view the title of fellow as conveying a special honor. Rather, it is a way to describe some people who spend more than a few hours at the school. We invited Chelsea Manning to spend a day at the Kennedy School. Specifically, we invited her to meet with students and others who are interested in talking with her and then to give remarks in the forum where the audience would have ample opportunity, as with all of our speakers, to ask hard questions and challenge what she has said and done. On that basis, we also named Chelsea Manning a visiting fellow. We did not intend to honor her in any way or to endorse any of her words or deeds, as we do not honor or endorse any fellow. However, I now think that designating Chelsea Manning as a visiting fellow was a mistake for which I accept responsibility. Therefore, we are withdrawing the invitation to her to serve as a visiting fellow and the perceived honor that it implies to some people, while maintaining the invitation for her to spend a day at the Kennedy School and speak in the forum." And he concluded with this apology, "I apologize to her and to the many concerned people from whom I've heard today for not recognizing up front the full implications of our original invitation." That would be Chelsea Manning, we said on last week's show, invited to accept and accepted a one-day fellowship at Harvard University. Harvard University then revoked that fellowship. Speeches from 2015 have revealed a number of homophobic and transphobic comments from Jeff Mateer, who is, of course, Donald Trump's nominee for a federal judgeship. Those comments included one where he said that trans children are evidence of, quote, Satan's plan. That's right. Transgender children are evidence of, quote, Satan's plan. This is Jeff Mateer, who is a nominee for a federal judgeship. Donald Trump's nominee for a federal judgeship. Mateer also has said that same-sex marriage would lead to polygamy and bestiality and expressed dismay at the banning of conversion therapy. Mateer is currently the first Assistant Attorney General of Texas, and if confirmed by the Senate, he will serve on the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas. At the time of the speeches, he was serving as General Counsel of the religious freedom advocacy group First Liberty Institute. In a speech in May of 2015, which, you know, wasn't that long ago, in May 2015, Mateer talked about a case in Colorado where the parents of a young transgender girl sued her school for not allowing her to use the girl's bathroom. And Mateer said this, quote, "I forget the sex. She's a girl who thinks she's a boy or a boy who thinks she's a girl. It's probably that, a boy who thinks she's a girl." He then said, quote, "It really just shows you how Satan's plan is working and the destruction that's going on." He then discussed the Supreme Court's ruling that allowed same-sex marriage, which had only happened a few months before he gave that speech. He said that there now would be no line. He continued by saying that disgusting sex acts would be normalized. He said this, quote, "Why couldn't four people want to get married? Why not one man and three women, or three women and one man? And we're going to spare you some of those slides. We actually have a presentation that we get into it. And I'll tell you, we say it's PG-13. It may be R, or what do they call the next one? NC-17 or whatever. There are people who marry themselves. Someone wanted to marry a tree. People marrying their pets. You read the New Testament and you read about all the things and you think, oh, that's not going on in our community. Oh, yes, it is. We're back to that time where debauchery rules." That is Jeff Mateer speaking right around 2 years ago, not that long ago. He is now up for a federal judgeship. Let's stay in some legal news. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit against the state of Michigan for allowing adoption services to refuse same-sex couples. Michigan pays private agencies to provide child welfare services, providing children with foster care and looking to find them foster and adoptive families. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is allowing these services to turn away homes for the children on the grounds of religious objection because the prospective parents are gay. Despite Michigan having 13,000 children in its overstretched foster system, forced to separate siblings and move children across the state in order to find them homes, faith-based agencies are still turning down potential loving homes because of homophobia. The bill that allows this was signed into law by Governor Rick Snyder in June of 2015. The ACLU is suing Michigan in federal district court for violation of the Constitution. They say that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which disallows the use of religious criteria in the provision of government services, is being violated, as is the Equal Protection Clause, because same-sex couples are being discriminated against. The executive director of the Movement Advancement Project, Inique Mushevik, said this, quote, "These bills are primarily driven by anti-LGBT animus. However, because explicitly targeting LGBT people would be clearly unconstitutional, the bills are written very broadly. Very few people understand how profoundly harmful the effects of this type of legislation could be." So that's the ACLU filing suit against the state of Michigan. You have all of these kids in the foster system, 13,000 children in the foster system. And we have these incredible couples who are stepping up and saying, yes, we want one of these children in our home. Here is our incredible family. Here is our home. We are opening up our lives in this way. And we are allowing for discrimination in that process. How absolutely ridiculous is that? 13,000 children in foster care. Alabama, North Dakota, South Dakota, Mississippi, Texas, and Virginia all have similar laws that allow children placement services to choose couples based on religious grounds. These laws not only discriminate against same-sex couples, but could also be used to turn away single parents or families who don't share the agency's faith. Statistics from the United States Department of Health and Human Services say that there are 428,000 children in foster care in the United States. The need for families is desperate, the ACLU says, and as data shows, same-sex couples are 4 times more likely to adopt and 6 times more likely to foster. These faith-based organizations, in effect, are actively preventing children from having stable homes. Come on. I mean, come on. These kids need homes. Why are we turning away incredible, incredible parents? Yeah. How about some positive news? Gay sportsman Robbie Rogers is the new face of Target clothing. The out soccer player is to front the major U.S. chain's new range Goodfellow and Company. He is the former Leeds United star. He came out as gay in 2013 while announcing his retirement from professional soccer, but he has since come out of retirement and now plays for the LA Galaxy. He posted on Instagram that he was excited to partner with Target. He wrote, quote, "Had so much fun a few weeks ago filming with Target. I'm really excited to be partnering with them to launch their all-new brand. Lucky enough to have explored the line, and I'll be sharing some of my favorites over the next few weeks." The choice of a gay man to front the campaign has been welcomed by LGBT groups. Outsports, that great organization, said this, quote, "We're thankful to Target for featuring an out gay man with a fiance and a baby in their campaign, and we continue to be grateful to Rogers for his willingness to be a voice and a face for LGBT equality." That is out gay soccer player Robbie Rogers. Major deal there with Target. Let's turn to Arizona. The Arizona Supreme Court has ruled that a lesbian divorcee should be afforded the same parental rights as her straight counterparts. The court ruled that a lesbian woman who is getting a divorce from her wife is entitled to the parental rights as protected by the United States Constitution. This latest ruling comes despite the fact that Arizona state law does not protect same-sex couples. Tucson couple Kimberly and Susan McLaughlin had a baby through artificial insemination, but they later separated. Despite having a shared parental arrangement, Kimberly had sought different custody rights after they broke up. This case has now set a precedent by the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of same-sex marriage applying in all states. The court went further to say that a number of state laws in Arizona should be rewritten in order to avoid litigation from individual cases similar to this. The women had used artificial insemination to get pregnant, but state law currently states that the man in a marriage is legally the father of any child born within 10 months of marrying. The current laws don't offer any protective rights to a same-sex parent in a married relationship where artificial insemination is used. Rather than throwing out the law entirely, the court's ruling effectively extends it to women in other similar circumstances. Arizona Chief Justice Scott Bales wrote in his opinion this, quote, "It would be inconsistent with the Supreme Court case to conclude that same-sex couples can legally marry, but states can then deny them the same benefits of marriage afforded opposite-sex couples." This is one of a number of similar cases making their way through state courts since the 2015 marriage equality case. Laws and regulations differ greatly across the 50 states. So we will see what happens with that. Let's do our weekly update. It would not be This Show Is So Gay these days without some sort of update about trans people in the military. Republican Senator John McCain has put his support behind a new effort to block Donald Trump's transgender ban. Donald Trump's Defense Secretary James Mad Dog Mathis is pushing ahead with the administration's plan to ban transgender people from the military. In the face of multiple civil rights lawsuits, Trump officials are drawing up plans to block recruitment of any military personnel who identify as transgender, while they are working on plans to purge existing soldiers from next year. As supporters of LGBT rights in Congress rush to try and block the president's action on the issue, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, has backed the plan. McCain was joined by Democrats Kristen Gillibrand and Jack Reed and Republican colleague Senator Susan Collins in launching the new bill. Collins and Gillibrand, and we covered this last week, previously attempted to move an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to tackle the ban, but they were blocked by Senate Republicans. But the new bill will have far more clout as it is backed by John McCain. The bill would block the Department of Defense from involuntarily separating or denying the reenlistment or continuation in service in the armed forces of currently serving transgender service members solely on the basis of the member's gender identity. It would also require Secretary Mathis to complete his review of accession of transgender individuals into the armed forces by the end of this year and to report the results to Congress. Senator McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said this, quote, "When less than 1% of Americans are volunteering to join the military, we should welcome all those who are willing and able to serve our country. Any member of the military who meets the medical and readiness standards should be allowed to serve, including those who are transgender. The Senate Armed Services Committee will review the results of the Department of Defense study on accession and will continue to work closely with our military leaders on any policy changes as we conduct oversight on this important issue." Senator Gillibrand, the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Personnel, said this, quote, "Despite being denied a vote on my bipartisan amendment to defend our transgender service members, we are not giving up in this fight. I am so grateful to Chairman McCain, Senator Collins, and Ranking Member Reed for joining me to introduce this bipartisan bill to block the Defense Department from kicking transgender troops out of the military. Thousands of brave transgender Americans love our country enough to risk their lives for it, fight for it, and even die for it, and Congress should honor them and let them serve. Doing otherwise would only harm our readiness at a time when our military is deployed around the world in defense of our country. I am proud to lead this fight in the Senate, and I urge all of my colleagues to join us in supporting this bill." There you go. More and more efforts to block this ban on trans people serving in the military. We have to do that. That is super important. They cannot be blocked. These are individuals, again, less than 1% of Americans are making this sacrifice to deny trans people the opportunity to serve their country when so many of us, 99% of us, are not doing it. That makes absolutely no sense. Big news this week out of Georgia Tech University. Violent protests broke out at a peaceful vigil held for an LGBTQ student who was shot dead by campus police this week. Scout Schultz, the LGBTQ student president at Georgia Tech University, was shot to death on Saturday night. The non-binary bisexual intersex student was pronounced dead that night at the hospital after they were shot by campus police. Students gathered this week to hold a vigil for Schultz, who was a fourth-year computer engineering student. They chanted, "Who's Tech? Scouts Tech," while holding candles in remembrance. However, the vigil turned violent after an estimated 50 people marched to Georgia Tech Police Headquarters, and by 9:30 p.m., a riot had broken out. A police SUV was set on fire, and two officers were injured, with one requiring medical treatment at the hospital. Georgia Tech University issued an emergency alert and asked students to stay inside. So a really tragic turn of events there at Georgia Tech. Let's go to some happy news, please. Yes, we could use it. Lena Waithe has made history at the Emmy Awards this week as she became the first Black woman to win the award for comedy writing. Waithe, who is an openly lesbian woman, won the award for co-writing the Master of None episode Thanksgiving. While accepting the award, she made an impassioned speech about the importance of diversity in entertainment. She said this, quote, "Thank you for embracing a little Indian boy from South Carolina and a little queer Black girl from the South Side of Chicago. We appreciate it more than you could ever know. My LGBTQIA family, I see each and every one of you. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it." I love that. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it. I'm doing it, right? We got to leave the house every day, or if you work from home, whatever it is, put on your cape. How are you using your voice to make a difference? Love that. Absolutely love that story. A woman who volunteered at a church to help families devastated by Hurricane Harvey has been fired after the church came to realize her religion and sexuality. The Calvary Church in Friendswood, Texas, and that seems to be a misnomer, called for volunteers to help at the food bank at the church after the hurricane ripped through the homes of hundreds of people. Carmen Hicks decided to take a week off work and donated $500 worth of food to the church in order to help. However, she was shocked after she was allegedly called in by the church's pastor, Ron Hint, and told she could no longer help at the church because of her sexuality and religion. Carmen Hicks told Outsmart this, quote, "I thought they wanted to talk to me about further volunteer efforts. I was so unprepared for the conversation that ensued." Hicks recounted how the pastor called her into his office to question why she said shalom after prayers. When she told him that it was because she was Jewish, she was asked to leave and not return. When she arrived home, she called the church to complain and was invited back in. She accepted the invite, believing that she would be apologized to. But instead, when she returned, the pastor began to question her over rumors about her sexual orientation. Hicks said this, quote, "He informed me that it was thought or it was rumored that I am a lesbian, which is against their Christian beliefs. I told Pastor Ron that when they called me to volunteer, they didn't bother to ask me to check or to not check those boxes, Jewish and lesbian." Hicks said that she told him that when she was needed, her identity was not an issue, but since the efforts were dwindling down, she was being disregarded. The pastor then reportedly told Hicks that he can't let her represent their church, as being a lesbian is a sin. And Hicks said, quote, "I let him know that he should be ashamed to call himself a Christian." Let's end with a happy story. A gay bar, well, kind of happy, at least in the circumstances, a gay bar in Key West, Florida, opened its doors to help hundreds of people forced out of their homes by Hurricane Irma. In Key West, Florida, a local gay bar stepped up in the wake of the hurricane to help the community. Jim Gillerin, the owner of the 801 Bourbon Bar in the city, opened the venue as a hub to distribute donated food items. The bar owner told the Palm Beach Post, quote, "My father taught me to take care of myself and my family so I can take care of my community." Mr. Gillerin said on Facebook, quote, "Hurricane Irma was quite a blow to Key West, and it will take the island and our establishment time to get back to our abnormal. Rest assured that we will, and have been rolling our sleeves up and getting back to 100% as soon as we can. I am proud of everyone who has kept a level head through this historic event." Again, whatever it is that you guys do, whatever it is that you do, whether you are opening up your establishment to provide refuge for people, whether you are Edie Windsor in the amazing way that she used her voice, whether you are Dr. Gail Pittman, and our thanks to her for doing such incredible work to use her voice. She's teaching courses, she's writing children's books, she's making me feel like a slacker. Whatever it is, I encourage, I implore you all to get out there, put on your cape, and make a difference. While you're using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, while you are wearing your cape, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?